Let's get down to business. We're studying lessons of Jesus, lessons that Jesus taught. And I'm finding this to be a very interesting study because Jesus said and did some very perplexing things. And at times, some of the things he said were just downright weird. I mean, there's no way of getting around it. Take, for instance, what he said in Matthew 19, verses 23 and 24. Then Jesus says to his disciples, "I tell you the truth. It is very hard for a rich person to get into the kingdom of heaven. I'll say it again. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God." And I have read a lot of commentaries that do all kinds of mental gymnastics trying to call this eye of the needle a gate in Jerusalem, and the camel had to get on his knees, and yada, yada, yada. And frankly, I don't think it's that complicated, okay? I think Jesus meant exactly what he said, and he meant it to sound weird, to stress the difficulty that we have taking spiritual things as seriously as we take material things. And I think he wanted us to go away saying, "What?" And think about it for a while. So I don't think he was, you know, it was that difficult to understand. How about this one? This is a great one. If your eye, even if it's your good eye, not your glass eye, but if this is your good eye, if it causes you to lust, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your hand, even if it is your stronger hand, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, looking around this room, I bet nobody is applying those verses to their lives because you all look fairly intact. That's kind of a strange thing to say, isn't it? How would you like that to be the application for today's message? Go cut out your eye or something. Or how about this one? Jesus said, "I say to you, if you are angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call somebody an idiot, you're in danger of being brought before the high council. And if you curse someone, you're in danger of the fires of hell." You know, I can't even get home from church without blowing this one. I mean, this is a toughie, and it's kind of strange. Why would he take those things so seriously? When we think about the lessons that Jesus taught, our first reaction, my first reaction anyway, is to think about the parables. So, I mean, those are actually lessons, right? Or the few sermons that are recorded in the Gospels. But that's not the way he taught much of the time, or I think, in fact, most of the lessons that he taught. Most of his teaching were more object lessons that came out of their everyday experiences with him than they were formal teaching sessions. Take, for instance, the number of times that you see recorded in the Gospels that seemingly out of the blue, he walks up to somebody and he says, "Follow me." What's always amazed me about that is how often people he said that to dropped what they were doing and followed him. They left. Take, for instance, Matthew 4, 18 through 20. And Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee. He saw two brothers, Simon, called Peter, and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will make you fishers of men." At once, it seems like without hesitation, at once they left their nets and they followed him. The next two verses, verse 21 and 22, a little further up the shore, he saw two other brothers, James and John, sitting in a boat with their father Zebedee, mending their nets. And he called them to come too. And immediately they followed him, leaving the boat and their father behind. I wonder how Zebedee felt about that. "There go my deckhands. Thanks a lot. See ya." Matthew 9:9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. In each instance, it seems like they either turned him down or they dropped what they were doing instantly and without hesitation and followed him. Has that ever struck you as being just a little bit strange? I have wondered about that a long, long time. How people and why would people drop what they were doing and walk away from their lives and take up with Jesus just because he said, follow me. Well, I found what I believe is one of the best explanations of this on a short video by a pastor named Rob Bell. He's a founding pastor of Mars Hill Bible Church. I think it's in Milwaukee. It's somewhere up there in the dark reaches of the north in the cold country. And I want to play it for you in its entirety tonight because I think it will do the best job conveying all that is couched in this simple little phrase, follow me. Now, I could have just ripped him off and told you about it and had you leaving here thinking I was absolutely brilliant. And that thought is not without a certain amount of appeal to me. But really, there is, I think there is a profound lesson to be learned in the visual aspects of this video as well. And I don't want you to miss those things. So some of you follow along in your notes, and you'll be totally frustrated by today's notes because they're not fill-in-the-blank things. Some of this stuff you're not going to answer tonight. I didn't intend for you to. I want you to think about it and wrestle with it through the week. There are a few of those answers in there, a few of those questions that you can't answer in the video. So listen carefully to what he has to say, but also watch carefully to this powerful message.
I want to be the kind of person who does the right thing. And I don't just mean the big things, where right and wrong are obvious and easy, but I mean the small things, the subtle, unnoticed things, like helping my neighbor when she's shoveling a driveway. You know, what I do when no one's watching. Because it's so easy to let those small things slip away. And it's those endless choices that we make every day that shape us and the kinds of people that we are. But this has started to change for me recently because I've started to believe different things about myself. A friend of mine gave me insight into the story about Jesus and his disciples that I'd heard before, but it's just taken on whole new meaning. Jesus' disciples are in a boat. And it's the middle of the night, and they're trying to get across the lake, and the wind is blowing, and it's getting choppy, and Jesus comes walking out to them on the water. Now they think he's a ghost. So they're like, Jesus, is it you? And he says, yes. And one of them, Peter, gets out of the boat and starts walking on the water towards Jesus. What is Peter thinking? And why Does he believe that he can walk on water? Now, what I've come to realize is the story makes way more sense if you understand the background. Jesus is a Jewish rabbi with Jewish disciples living in a first century Jewish world. Now, Jesus grew up in a region called the Galilee, and the Jewish people in the Galilee believed that God had spoken to Moses, one of their great historical leaders, and had given him the first five books of the Bible. They called these first five books the Torah. Torah means like teaching or instructions or simply the way. And so Torah was the center, the foundation of their lives, and it was the focus of their educational system. So most Jewish boys or girls around the age of six would go to school for the first time to learn the Torah. It'd probably be held in the local synagogue and be taught by a local Torah teacher who was a rabbi. This first level of education was called Beit Sefer and lasted until the kid was around 10 years old. In Beit Sefer, most kids would memorize the Torah and by the age of 10 have the Torah by heart, every word, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, memorized. Now, by the end of Beit Sefer, which would be around 10 years of age, most kids were no longer going to school. They were learning the family trade, learning the family business, learning how to manage a household. But the best of the best would keep going. They would continue their education into the next level, which was called Beit Talmud. In Beit Talmud, the best of the best who were still going on, the ones with the most natural ability, would memorize the rest of the Hebrew scriptures. Genesis through Malachi, memorized. Now, by the end of Beit Talmud, 14, 15, most kids are learning the family business, learning the family trade, apprenticing with their parents. But the best of the best of the best would continue on to the next level of education, which was called Beit Midrash. And they'd go to a rabbi and they'd apply to that rabbi to become one of that rabbi's disciples. Now, when we use the word disciple, we often mean student, but we generally mean somebody who knows what the teacher knows. But a disciple is something far deeper. A disciple just doesn't want to know what the rabbi knows. A disciple wants to be like the rabbi and wants to learn to do what the rabbi does. Now, rabbis differed in how they interpreted the Torah. They would take like a verse or a command, and one rabbi might say, well, this is what it means to follow this verse or to do this command of God. But another rabbi might say, no, I think it means something slightly different. And so different rabbis had different sets of interpretations about how they lived out and understood and interpreted the scriptures. Now, a rabbi's set of interpretations was called that rabbi's yoke. So when you went and applied to a rabbi to become one of that rabbi's disciples, what you wanted to do is you wanted to take that rabbi's yoke upon you so that you could learn to know what the rabbi knows, in order to do what the rabbi does, in order to be like the rabbi. So you'd go to a rabbi and you'd say, Rabbi, I want to become one of your disciples. The rabbi would then grill you. The rabbi would ask you questions about Torah, questions about the prophets, questions about the oral tradition, because the rabbi wants to know, can this kid sit in front of me? Can this kid do what I do? Can this kid spread my yoke? Does this kid have what it takes? So the rabbi would fire off all these questions and grill the kid. And if the rabbi thought this kid's good, this kid loves God, loves Torah, but this kid isn't the best of the best of the best, the rabbi might say to the kid, you know, you obviously love God and you obviously know the Torah, but you don't have what it takes to become one of my disciples. And so the rabbi might say something like, go and continue learning your family trade, continue plying your family trade. But if the rabbi thinks this kid has got it, I think this kid could do what I do, the rabbi would say to the kid, come, follow me. And so you would leave as this, 14, 15-year-old kid, you would leave your family, your friends, your synagogue, your village, and you would devote your entire life to being like your rabbi, learning to do what your rabbi does. This is what it means to be a disciple. Yours is much the same. Story again. So, a rabbi comes to town. A powerful rabbi. He's got like his little pack of disciples with him, and they're doing everything they can to keep up with him because they've devoted their lives to doing what their rabbi does. So if you're a disciple, by the end of the day with your rabbi traveling on these hot, dusty, dirty roads, you've got whatever your rabbi stepped in just caked all over the front of you. And so this saying developed among the wise men and the sages that you would say to a disciple, you'd say, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. This is a scene that everybody had seen this. They knew exactly what it meant to be covered in the dust of your rabbi. Now, all of this, to me, has huge implications for Jesus and how we understand Jesus, because most rabbis would begin their teaching around the age of 30. And in the Bible, around the age of 30, we have Jesus walking down the shore along the Sea of Galilee, and he comes across Peter and Andrew, and they're fishermen, and Jesus says to them, come, follow me. Well, if they're fishermen and Jesus calls them to be his disciples, then they're not following another rabbi. And if they're not following another rabbi, they're not the best of the best. They didn't make the cut. And the text continues. It says that at once they dropped their nets and followed him, which I've always thought is a bit strange. I mean, it's odd, isn't it? That they just drop them and go. And I don't, some of those Christian movies don't help, do they? I mean, it's like Jesus comes down the beach and he's in this white bathrobe and he has this light blue beauty pageant sash on, you know, and his hair is blow dried and he's Swedish. And he calls the disciples, and they're kind of these robots. They kind of come around and go after him. If you understand it, like in its original context, it starts to make perfect sense. I mean, rabbis were the most honored, respected, revered people anywhere. I mean, the best of the best of the best are the only ones who got to be rabbis. And this rabbi comes down the beach and says to you, come follow me. Well, what's he really saying? What he's really saying is, I think you could do what I do. I mean, he's saying you can be like me. Of course you drop your nets and follow him. And then the text even continues. It says that he comes across James and John, and they're fishing with their father Zebedee. Now, if they're fishing with their father, what are they? They're apprentices. They're learning the family business. And if he calls them to be his disciples, and they're not the disciples of some other rabbi. So James and John, they're not good enough. They didn't make the cut either. They aren't the best of the best. And how old are they? 15? 16? I mean, 20? I mean, these are not old men. They're young. I mean, Jesus chooses them because his movement is for everybody. I mean, it's for rich and for poor and for women and men and educated and uneducated. I mean, actually, what's one of the things they say about them later on? One of the things they say about them later on is these guys are like unschooled fishermen. I mean, it's for the peasants and the scholars. It's like a movement of anybody's, and he calls them the JV, the B team, the not good enoughs. He calls them to be his disciples, and they change the course of human history. So back to the walking on water thing. I mean, you have this boat full of anybody's. And the water's choppy and the wind's blowing and they're terrified because this Jesus comes across the water to them and they think he's a ghost. And then Peter says, well, if it's you, then tell me to come to you. Now, why is this Peter's first response? Why is Peter's first reaction, if it's you, then tell me to come to you? Because he's a disciple. I mean, he's oriented his whole life, devoted his whole life to doing what he sees his rabbi doing, learning to be like his rabbi. So he sees his rabbi walking on water, and what's the first thing he wants to do? I want to walk on water too. I want to be like my rabbi. And so Peter gets out of the boat, and he starts walking on the water, but he starts to sink, and he yells out, Jesus, save me. And the text reads that Jesus immediately caught him and said, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Now, I always assumed that Peter doubts Jesus, but Jesus isn't sinking. Who does Peter doubt? He doubts himself. He loses faith in himself that he can actually be like his rabbi. I mean, Jesus wouldn't have called him if he didn't think he could be like him. Jesus even reminds his disciples of this at one point. He says to them, wait, you didn't choose me, I chose you. The rabbi doesn't choose you unless the rabbi thinks that you can do what he does, that you can be like him. I mean, all my life I've heard people talk about believing in God. But God believes in us, in you. In me. I mean, faith in Jesus is important, but what about Jesus' faith in us? I mean, he must have faith in us because he leaves it all in the hands of these disciples. And what's the last thing Jesus says to them? He says to them, now you go and make more disciples. He leaves it all in the hands of these anybodies, and they do it. I mean, what if we can actually be the kinds of people that God created us to be? What if he actually believes that? I mean, what if he actually believes that we can be the kind of people who live like Jesus lived? and the kinds of people who take action because we're aware of all of these endless opportunities around us all the time for good, for beauty, for truth. I mean, Jesus has faith that you can follow him and you can be like him. He believes it. God, but may you come to see that God believes in you. May you have faith in Jesus, but may you come to see that Jesus has faith that you can be like him, a person of love and compassion and truth, a person of forgiveness and peace and grace and joy and hope, and may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi, Jesus.
You know, I think to me, one of the key comments that Bell makes in this video is this: I want to be the kind of person who does the right thing. And I don't just mean the big things where right and wrong are obvious and easy, but I mean the small things, the subtle, unnoticed things. And that right there gets to the heart of what it means to be a disciple or being a follower of Jesus, is being the kind of person who does the right thing, even the little things, you notice things, the things that Jesus did. At its heart, being a disciple, being a follower of Christ, means being like Christ in the big things, but also in the small, the subtle, the unnoticed things. Now, why are these small, unnoticed things such big things? I believe it is because they are the things that really demonstrate to the watching world around us that we really are, or what we really are, at the core of our being. And it demonstrates to the world the reality of the beliefs that we say we hold to. Now, being a disciple isn't easy. It takes time and it takes discipline. That's where the root for disciple comes from. In a world like ours that's really into instant everythings, not many people are willing to expend the energy and take the time that it takes to become a disciple. Now, I read a really great illustration of this in an article in Christianity Today this week, by a woman named Barbara Nicolosi. She is the founder and director of an organization called Act One, and it is a Christian organization. Their mission is to train committed Christian writers to work in the Hollywood film industry. That's quite a challenge, isn't it? She says this: I was giving a talk at a Christian college, and a young Jeremy sprung to his feet as soon as the question period began. He followed up with, "Tell me what I need to do to make the next Passion of the Christ." In other words, I want to do something really big for God. What are the four steps that I take, that I need to take to do that? I love her answer. Suddenly, I had a whole new insight into the gospel passage between Jesus and the rich young man. That's in Matthew 19, if you want to check it out later. I think I kept the sigh out of my voice. Give away everything that you have and now are doing so that you can throw yourself into mastering the cinematic art form. Get your act together spiritually and then do everything you can do to get into a top film school. Study philosophy and theology so that you have something real to say through your movies. Read lots of classic novels. Write hundreds of pages so that you achieve command of the language as a creative tool. Get your moral act together so that you won't be tripped up too easily in the world of the entertainment business. Then come follow us by moving to Los Angeles, and in 10 or 15 years, maybe you'll get to see your name on the screen appended to a movie of lasting value. Needless to say, the young man, like the young man in the gospel, Jeremy's face fell, and he too went away sad. Why? Because there is no easy steps to big things for God. I love what she says. She says, the passion of the Christ did not come out of nowhere. It came 30 years into Mel Gibson's filmmaking experience, mainly at top levels of the industry. It came almost a decade after he produced his Oscar-winning film, Braveheart. It came 15 years after his profound conversion and the reorienting of his life to Christ. The film itself took 10 years of a brooding, devastating creative journey. Many people in the church have been asking me if in the wake of the Passion's success, Hollywood will produce much more movies. Hollywood can't. There will be no other Passions without other Mel Gibsons to bring them into being. See, she's saying that you cannot give what you do not possess. You have to be before you can put those things out there. You have to become a follower of Christ. And that's hard work, and it takes time. It's not an instant thing. But the good news is, becoming a follower of Christ is open to anybody. Like Bell says, it's open to the anybodies of the world. It's not reserved for an exclusive club of elites. But it is reserved for people who are willing to pay the price of discipleship and to daily take up their cross and follow Jesus. In a culture that is wowed by big things, why are the small things, the unnoticed things, the subtle things, such big things? Because those are the very things that demonstrate to a watching world, and they are watching, what we really are in the core of our being. Not what we have the ability to do, but who we really are. And it reveals on a deep level the true nature of what we say we believe. Now, how did these early disciples of Jesus change the course of human history, as Bell suggests? Well, Jesus gave them a hint to this. He told them how it was going to happen, if it was to happen at all, in John 13, 34 and 35. He says, "But I am giving you a new command. You must love each other just as I have loved you." In other words, follow my example. I have loved you, now you do the same to other people. And if you do that, if you love each other like I have loved you, then guess what? Everyone will know that you are my disciples. You won't have to pound it into people's heads. They'll know. They'll see it. They'll get it. Now, how did Jesus love his disciples? According to John 13, 1 through 4, it was by washing their feet, an act of simple, humble service to them. It was that same selfless service to other people that caused the early church to stand out in stark contrast to the dark world in which they lived. I've been working through this book, The Rise of Christianity by Rodney Stark. It's really an interesting read. In there, he states that the Roman Empire was hit by two severe plagues in the first century and another one in the second century. The first was probably smallpox. The second one was probably measles, and that can be devastating to a population that has not been exposed to those things and haven't built up any immunities to them. Scholars estimate that somewhere between 1/4 to 1/3 of the population of the Roman Empire died in these two plagues. At the height of the second plague in 251, it is said that 5,000 people a day died in Rome alone It was huge. It was devastating. Now, how I got the thought came into my mind, how would we react as a church if we were undergoing such a severe experience as that? What would we do? My guess is that we would probably start having regular prayer meetings. We would fast an awful lot. And mainly our prayers to God would be, please make this go away. Make this stop. Or at least make it go around my house and my family, right? I mean, I want relief. I'm a Christian. I signed on the company line. I'm supposed to be immune to this stuff, right? I mean, that's kind of like our attitude today. But Cyprian, Dionysius, Eusebius, and other church fathers thought, get this, that the epidemics made major contributions to the spread of Christianity. In their minds, these plagues were essential to the power of the gospel going out and spreading rampantly throughout the entire Roman Empire. Now, how did that work? That seems like the opposite in my mind. It happened because their behavior was so distinct from the pagan world around them that their faith had to be taken seriously, even by the most adamant opponents. As the epidemic worsened, get this, as it got worse and worse and worse, the pagan priests, the civil authorities, the wealthy families, those that had the means, even the doctors, because they had money too, left. They hightailed it out of town. They were not dumb. They knew, you get all these people together, we're going to get sick too if we stick around here. Adios, good luck, see ya. And they left. They moved to the burbs. And they left them hanging. The Christians stayed. And they ministered, they served. Dionysius in 250 described the typical treatment of the world by towards the sick. At the first onset of the disease, they pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, those closest to them, throwing them into the roads before they were dead and treated unburied corpses as dirt. This was in stark contrast to the Christian community that nursed the sick and the dying and prepared their bodies for proper burials. Dionysius continued, he said, most of our brother Christians showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves and thinking only of one another. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ, and with them departed this life serenely happy, for they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbors and cheerfully accepting their pains. Many, in nursing and curing others, transferred their death to themselves and died in their stead. The best of our brothers lost their lives in this manner. A number of presbyters, deacons, and laymen winning high commendation so that the death in this form, the result of great piety and strong faith, seems in every way equal to martyrdom. Their behavior stood out in stark contrast because they were doing the things their rabbi did. And it showed that they were true followers of Christ. As a result, Christianity spread like wildfire throughout the Roman world. And it wasn't because of the great, huge, citywide campaigns they did. And it wasn't because of their mass media or multimedia events that they did. It was simply due to the selfless acts of service that followers of Christ rendered to the people around them. That was it. In 362, about 100 years after the second of these plagues, the Emperor Julian, the apostate, tried to stamp out Christianity and revive paganism once again. And in a letter to the high priest of Galatia, he complained that, get this, the pagans needed to at least equal the virtues of Christians. They were behind. They needed to at least get up to speed with the Christians, for recent Christian growth was caused by their moral character, even if pretended. If they don't really mean it, it's a pretty good act. It's a pretty good sales job. So we got to get up to speed with these guys. We got to catch up with them. And it was their benevolence towards strangers and the care for the graves of the dead. In other words, Christianity was spreading throughout the empire because of the believers, the followers of Christ, willingly laid down their lives in service to others. And with chagrin, he acknowledged that his fellow pagans didn't even help each other. He said, those who belong to us look in vain to the help that we should render them. We should be helping them, and we're not. But these Christians, these unbelievers, these infidels are. Many of you know that I do a lot of work down on the Navajo Reservation as part of my Mission to the Americas thing that I do. And I started going to the Navajo Reservation, you know, I think this is our eighth year. It's kind of a blur now, but it's been a while. It was really interesting. We used to go to Mexico, taking our fellow churches down there and a bunch of kids. And if you pull up in to any barrio along the Mexican border in a church van loaded with high school kids, you would swear you just liberated Paris. I mean, they will almost, if they had roses, they'd throw them at your feet. I mean, they just come out and hug on you, and you were like the greatest thing since sliced bread. That's how you feel. But in Caibito, we were like lower than low. I mean, people wouldn't even talk to us. We would go out to work on people's houses, and they would be gone. You couldn't find a Navajo anywhere near any of our work teams. When our kids and some of the adults would go down to the local store, there's one store in Caibito, a little trading post, gas station and that, and they would go down there to buy, you know, candy and soda and that stuff, and if there were any Navajo people in line with them, they would switch from English to Navajo so that our people wouldn't even know what they were saying. I mean, we were just like, ugh, nothing. That's understandable because Christianity doesn't have a real good name among Native American people, especially the Navajo. They haven't been treated too well. And Christianity is equated with the white man's religion. One article started out this way. They came with a Bible in one hand and a gun in the other. That's our image, okay? That's what we were confronted with, and that's how we were treated. Tolerated, but not really welcomed or appreciated. Well, the second year, as I got to meet more people and know more people, I invited the chapter president, who was, I guess, on an equivalent to the main county supervisor in our context, and his name was Philip Brown, and I invited him to come out to the camp and at night during our evening services, and I wanted to introduce him to the group, and he could say something, you know, hi, how you doing, go home, or something like, you know, whatever he wanted. And he comes out there, and I think that year we had 300 kids out there. We took over the football field. Kids all over the place, you know, and they're singing and going wild and all stuff. And he looks at that, and he kind of gives me a sort of a bewildered look, and he says, where are you guys from? And I said, well, mostly Northern California area. I mean, you know, by the coast and up in the mountains, just all over the place, you know. And he says, why are you coming all the way out here to help us? Well, that's one of those questions and moments when you have 5 seconds to give an answer. That's it. I couldn't give him a 4-point outline or showing my slide presentation, so I had to do the best I could without it. And I simply said to him, because Jesus came all the way from heaven to help us with our sin problem, and we're simply following his example. That's it. That's our motive. Okay. Talk to him. Go away. Next year, come back and invite him back over to the camp. And, you know, they're more friendly now because they're getting to know us and they're starting to accept us, and we don't look like boogeymen. We're probably not going to hurt them or disrespect them. And he says it again. He says, where are you guys from? And I said, Northern California mostly, somewhere by the coast, you know, yada, yada. And he says, why do you guys keep coming out here to help us? There's my 5 seconds again. I said, same answer, same question. Okay, same answer. This is easy. I remember it from last year. Because Jesus came all the way from heaven to help us with our sin problem, and we're simply following his example. Period. That was it. That was it. Well, we keep going out there, and we start winning a good name for ourselves, but also for Christ. And I go out there 4 or 5 times a year, just visit everybody I know just to stay up to speed and keep in touch with everybody. And Stan is a man that, he's a believer, owns the local, the little store there in Caibito Market. And we're talking one day visiting, and he starts telling me about a conversation he had with Mr. Brown. And he says, you know, Mr. Brown is starting to come to church and check it out. And his wife is at our Bible study almost every week now. And he says, Philip Brown said just the other day, why can't our people be more like them? It's like, I almost cried right there in a grocery store in front of God and everybody. And I thought, wow, We're winning a good name. It's working. The simple acts of service. We didn't go there to preach to anybody. We went there to serve the way Jesus served. We went there to follow Jesus' example. If they said thank you, wonderful. If they didn't say thank you, if they ran away and ignored us, that's okay too. That's not what we're here for. We're here because Jesus came all the way from heaven to help us, and we are following his example. We want to be covered in the dust of our rabbi and do the things our rabbi does. See, we mistakenly draw the conclusion sometimes that these huge campaigns and these big blitz events are where the power is. That's where the action is. And I'm here to tell you, if I've said it once, I said it 1,000 times, and I'll say it again. That is not where the action is. The power of the gospel is in those simple acts of service with no strings attached. Simply serving because you're following your rabbi's example and you're being like him and thus spreading his yoke. Do you want to make a difference in the world with your life? Then do the things your rabbi did. Treat people the way Jesus did. Serve people the way Jesus did. Love people the way Jesus did. Especially love one another the way Jesus did. And then all men will know that you are my disciples. You will have a faith. You will display a faith that people will say, I don't know what's up with that, but I got to find out more. Let me just close with a prayer for us. May you believe in God, but may you come to see that God believes in you. May you have faith in Jesus, but may you come to see that Jesus has faith that you can be like him. A person of love and compassion and truth. A person of forgiveness and peace and grace and joy and hope. And may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi, Jesus. Amen.